What we're going to do is start taking testimony. We can't formally vote on these bills until we get the quorum, but I think there's general agreement to proceed on them and then just take a vote at the time when we get the quorum. They're pretty non-controversial, at least three of them are. And Representative Elstrom, I think yours is the least controversial, so you get to start. And the meeting will come to order. Representative Hestrom, I assume you move your House File 3000, and so go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if there's no objection from the Republicans as well, I'd hope that this could go to the consent calendar.
I think that'll be fine, Mr. Chair. Let's hear what you have to say, but I think it looks like that's a good place for this one to go.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Coles. Representative Hestrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3000 is simply a name change. In the statute, it said the Public Safety Radio Systems Planning Committee, and that is no longer the name of the committee. It is the Statewide Radio Board, and so it's just simply changing the name and statute to reflect what is currently going on. And that's it, Mr. Chair.
Wow, that sounds like a really...
Go to the
You're really giving up a lot there. Okay, thank you, Representative Hestrom. We can't vote on it now until we get a quorum, so I guess you're done for now.
For Mr. Wiggins, I have nothing else.
No, why isn't he still working in the House? that's all we have.
All right.
So thank you. Wish they'd all go that quick. Does anybody know the... I think I saw the people from Secretary of State's office. I don't think we need the author here. Do you want to come up, Beth, and explain? You probably can explain the bill a lot better than the author. So when we get a quorum, we'll be able to vote on your bill. But state your name for the record, and then this is House File 2991, and we can't do any formal moving it yet, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Fraser. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Secretary of State's office, and I know you can't move it, but there is a DE2 amendment to this bill. Since the last committee, the subcommittee meeting, we have been working and have worked out all the concerns with law enforcement, and the DE2 amendment reflects that agreement that we've come to. The bill deals with the Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program, which was a program that was passed in statute in late 2006 and went into effect September 1st of last year. And it's a new program both for the state and for our office, in that it expands what our office does. And this program provides survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking, and others who fear for their safety with a way to live more normal lives while still hiding from their abusers. It's a mail forwarding service, so we provide them with an address, a P.O. box, and all of the participants share that address, and we get all of their mail and forward it on to them. This bill is mostly technical corrections that we've realized needed to be put in place since we began implementing the program. In Section 1, we are defining mail. Currently, the statute says that we have to forward all mail, which isn't financially sustainable to continue to forward junk mail and catalogs and packages. So this says that we have to forward first-class letters and flats, which are large envelopes, as well as pharmaceuticals and any sort of package that's sent by a government agency but otherwise don't have to send packages, parcels, periodicals, or catalogs. Section 2 has to do with the application. It states that people in the program have to give consent for us to confirm or deny participation in the program as a condition of participation. If the person can provide their name and their lot number, each, that's kind of their ID number in the program. as well as participants have to provide any other information required by the Secretary of State. We have done rulemaking and have required in the rules that participants provide some additional information to what's in the statute, and want to be sure that participants have to provide that additional information before they can be accepted into the program. Section 3 does two things. One is that subdivision 1, the current statute prevents participants and others from consenting to release for any information. And that was put in place because there was a concern about participants being coerced into providing consent for release. What we found is that we would never want to release a participant's address based upon a consent for information, but that there are cases in which it would be helpful in which if participants could consent to release for other information or more general information. For example, if somebody's trying to enroll their kids in a school and the school refuses to believe that they live in the school district, if the participant consented, we could confirm that they do live in the district. Subdivision 2 represents the agreement that we've come to with law enforcement and the Department of Public Safety, which would allow the secretary to share address or other data about the participants with the BCA if it's determined that that's needed for an emergency situation, criminal complaint, or investigation. This could be done expeditiously and without a court order. And then the BCA could share the data with the law enforcement personnel. Section 4 just clarifies that data, once released to law enforcement, is still private data and shouldn't be shared beyond what's necessary. Sections 5, 6, and 7 all relate to driver's licenses and state ID cards and clarify that participants can get a driver's license or state ID card only providing their P.O. box or designated address. This is so that all participants, including those whose abusers may have a connection to law enforcement or to driver and vehicle services, will feel safe, knowing that Safe at Home is the only place that has their address. I'd be happy to provide any additional information or answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Oh, Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Frazier, section 2 of the bill, the addition at the end of the application for any other information as required by the Secretary of State, I'm concerned about the breadth of that language. You referenced some rulemaking that's occurred with regard to the program. Why aren't we referring to the rules in the language here? I'm really uncomfortable with just giving the Secretary the ability to ask for whatever the Secretary wants without any kind of outside parameters on that. If you've already made rules, why can't we refer to the rules that have been made or maybe made in the future pursuant to this program?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cole, perhaps Mr. Gearing could answer this, but my expectation is that the only way that we could require additional information is by stating in rules that it's required.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Frazier, I absolutely 100% disagree with you. This says that the Secretary can ask for whatever the Secretary wants. If we refer to the rules, and if the Secretary's office is comfortable with doing that, you know, then there's at least a process that exists about what type of information the Secretary can request of an individual who's applying to be a part of this program. I'm terribly troubled by the breadth of this and without some kind of limitation. Mr. Gearing, I don't know if I'm reading that, if I'm not reading that correctly, but I think it's very broad.
Mr. Gearing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I think if you wanted to limit the scope a little bit, you could say that any other information as required by the Secretary of State as permitted by rule, if you wanted to be consistent with what the rules allow them to request.
Oh, Mr. Chair, when we get a quorum here, and an author maybe, because I'd like Representative Simon to have an opportunity to weigh in on this. I don't want to I'm a supporter of the Safe at Home program, but I'm concerned about this, so I'll be making that amendment at the appropriate time, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, a couple more questions very quickly, if I could, for Ms. Frazier.
Representative Coleslaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 3, Ms. Frazier, I guess I understand that your testimony that you've worked out some of the issues in Subdivision 2 with law enforcement. However, I got to be honest, I'm a little concerned about the language and the way it reads. It says that upon request from BCA, the secretary may share the private data with BCA when the secretary, in consultation with BCA, determines that release will promote public safety. So now we have the Secretary of State under this language making a determination about whether something does or does not promote public safety, which I'm not sure is currently within the realm of duties of the Secretary of State. That, to me, is a concern about kind of expanding the scope of the duties and responsibilities of the Secretary. Are there other places where the Secretary is asked to make a determination about public safety? I would much prefer to see the burden of determining whether something does or does not potentially impact public safety to rely on our public safety agencies like DPS or the BCA or some other law enforcement agency.
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, this is an issue that we did discuss with the law enforcement agencies, and I don't know if Mr. Gehring or Ms. Prius can provide some additional information. This question was raised, and it was discussed, and there was some determination. I don't see Ms. Engler from IPAC here, but there was some determination that since the Secretary holds the data, the Secretary needs to make some sort of determination before releasing the data. And so the language was changed to say that the determination would be made in consultation with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I don't know if Mr. Gehring or Ms. Briggs want to add to that.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, this language, I believe, is based on effectively the Data Practices Act that allows any government entity to declare certain data in its hands to be security data, and in that case, it can be released to law enforcement for purposes of public safety. The Data Practices Act probably wouldn't permit a different government entity to sort of declare that it can access data held by the Secretary of State or any other entity that is not its own, which is why the language is written the way it is.
Mr. Chair, Kristen Coles,
please
know that we would rely heavily on our consultation and the judgment of the BCA in this matter as to whether or not it would promote public safety.
Ms.
Curious,
did you? No, okay. Are you finished, so that Representative Coles can go ahead? Okay. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, while I understand what Mr. Gehring is saying, I'm not sure that resolves my concerns about this issue. There's been some history already with this secretary in terms of data sharing, and I'm concerned about that issue generally. I would ask Ms. Frazier one final question, just because I don't know the answer to it, and I'm a supporter of this program. How many individuals have applied for the Safe at Home program and are currently participating in it since the program was adopted back a few years ago?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, if I could just say a brief bit about this program and the way that we protect the data. We have hired professional staff to work exclusively on this program. They are housed in an office that is off-site in an undisclosed location. Only a handful of our staff even know where that office is. Only those staff have access to the participant data. It is stored on a computer that is not connected to the internet, so it cannot be hacked. So we are doing everything we can think of to protect this data. I oversee the program. It's kind of under me, and I don't know who's in the program or the names or addresses of the people. My understanding is that there are approximately 30 individuals in about 15 households in the program. It went into effect September 1st. The rules were adopted in late October, and So the program is still just getting started. Participants, in order to get into the program, have to meet with a trained application assistant, most of whom are housed in battered women's programs. And we've been, the first step, of course, is training the application assistant so that they're there to assist people in entering the program.
And Mr. Representative Colt,
we now have a quorum, so I can... the meeting will come to order. Representative Simon moves his Bill 2991 and then moves the DE2 amendment. All in favor of putting the bill in the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Okay. Representative Colt, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Frazier, I guess that begs one final question. How many FTEs then does the Secretary of State's office have designated for this program that is currently serving 30 people and may expand, but what's the staffing for this program?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, right now the staffing is about 2 FTEs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Frazier.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, back to page 2. Line 31, that any other information required by the Secretary of State, if we add in as described in rule, that's totally redundant. Because rule has the effect of law, so I don't know why we just don't delete that. I mean, I don't support the wide open window of anything, and if you put language in, this reference rule already has the effect of law, so I think that's kind of silly, but on to page 3 in the release of data, can you give me an example of information that would be shared by the Secretary of State that wouldn't already be covered under the broad authority that law enforcement already has for access to data for public safety and criminal investigation?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, and perhaps Mr. Gearing can help with this answer as well. Since the data is classified as private, my understanding is that it would take a court order in order for us to release the data.
Mr. Chair and
Representative Holberg,
I don't believe that's true. Law enforcement has a very wide latitude in gaining information from virtually any source in the course of a criminal investigation or to promote public safety. And so unless there's somewhere in this law that negates that ability, I don't even know why we need that section, number one. Number two, if we do need that section, which I heavily question, where in your bill or where in law does it provide for these participants to know that that data will be subject to that release in this process, i.e. the Tennyson warning on it?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, when applicants apply, we provide them with quite a bit of information about the program and how it works and under what circumstances data could or could not be released. And so they would be provided with a Tennyson warning as part of the application process.
So in other words, they would be made aware that the Secretary of State would be the arbiter of whether or not the release of data was in the public safety interest or not.
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, yes, in consultation with the Bureau of Criminal Affairs.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I'll work with Representative Simon. I think you got some real clinkers in here, and it's a good program, but I think this is a case of a lot of redundancy, and I mean, law enforcement has very broad ability to gain access to information, and I am too concerned about this Secretary of State role in determining whether or not it's warranted. I don't think it's the Secretary of State's job to make that call, and I think we can probably slim down the bill a little bit and still accomplish what needs to be accomplished.
Ms. Frazier.
Representative Holberg, this subdivision has been has been inserted into the bill at the request of law enforcement. So,
Representative Holberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd be really surprised that law enforcement would would have without request of the Secretary of State, given the Secretary of State the role that they have in this process and this bill.
Ms. Holberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, again, that part was
or Ms. Free.
worked out with Ms. Hearing, Ms. Prius, and iPad. And
any other comments on the bill? Representative Cole?
Mr. Chairman, now that Representative Feinman is here, Mr. Gehring, could you share again the language that you suggested for 2.31, the insertion with regard to reference to the rules that the Secretary promulgates under the program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cole, Representative Simon, the amendment would be on 2.31, at the end of the sentence, insert, comma, to the extent permitted by rule, period.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Coles moves the amendment at the end of line 2.31 to add comma to the extent permitted by rule. Representative Simon, do you want to comment on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, I consider that a friendly amendment.
Okay, then all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Is there any other discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would just note that, thank you, Mr. Chairman, I would just note that I had a brief discussion with Mr. Gehring about the language in Subdivision 2. I may have some suggestions for Representative Simon. I'll be happy to work with him and Representative Holberg. I'm uncomfortable about that language now. I'm willing to... I'm not looking to kill the bill here in committee, but I think that does need some work.
Representative Simon?
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering whether I could move a couple technical amendments, oral amendments.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, on line 1.24, we think it's best to change the word defined to the word identifiable so as to be consistent with other...
What's the other one?
The other one would be to change the effective date to June 1st, 2008. And I'm told that, fortunately, I don't know how we can do this necessarily cleanly, but there's more than one effective date throughout the... Oh, after every section. So I guess that would be... change line, I'm just swinging it here, Mr. Chair. I think that the changes would be on line 2.4,
2.32,
correct.
3.17, 3.23, 4.35, 5.25, and 6.16.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Cole?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a problem with the effective date change, I don't think, but I guess my question for Ms. Frazier would be, if the legislature does not adjourn until the middle of May, and this is one of those bills that ends up getting passed right at the end of session, is the Secretary's office going to have enough time to implement what's in this statute by June 1, which might be just 2 weeks later?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, yes, we would.
Okay. Representative Simon renews his motion to change the word defined to identifiable and then all the effective dates in there, as I read before, to this section is effective June 1, 2008. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries. Any more discussion on the bill? Okay, then this bill goes to the floor then. Representative Simon renews his motion to pass and re-refer it to the floor as amended several times. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Hillstrom makes the motion to pass House File 3000 and refer it to the consent calendar. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Kalin, are you ready?
Yes.
Representative Kalin moves House File 3099. From Kalen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
Go ahead and present your bill, Representative Kalen.
All right.
It's been moved.
House File 3099 is one of the bills that's a response to some of the lessons that we learned in light of the bridge collapse on August 1st, 2008. As we know, Minnesota had a lot to be proud of on that day. With me today is, I think, the chief respondent, the director of the response by City of Minneapolis, and the coordinated response, the incident, the coordinated command system, Rocco Forte from the City of Minneapolis, the emergency response director. And I think not only is Mr. Forte someone that we should all be proud of, but the entire team that responded to the bridge collapse. All hands were on deck except for one, and as we've learned, that not every single state agency was ready to fully participate in the emergency response as was, has been committed to out of the state emergency operations plan. After visiting the Emergency Operations Center in Minneapolis, seeing firsthand the great work that they did, but also hearing some concerns about a state agency's ability to step up to the plate and fulfill their full support role. I met with the Department of Public Safety, met with first responders and emergency management officials, and discovered that one of the things that we need to do is to require to give the Department of Public Safety a little bit of more authority to ensure that every emergency management official and state agency that is committed to participating in that response is able to fully do their job and is fully trained and is indeed certified in emergency management. I'm proud to say that House File 3099 before you is been thoroughly vetted by the Department of Public Safety, and I want to thank them for their time, and especially Commissioner Campion, Mr. Diebold, and others that that spent some time over the interim determining that most of the power already exists in what we have, but what we needed to do is just require that every state agency that has signed on to the state emergency operations plan is required to do so in state statute. I won't go through the trouble of reading every agency and division of state government that has done so, but I will just point out that we have signatures that one of the most important pages is just the signatures of all the leads, whether they're commissioners or directors of division. So we have full consent to implement the program. What we need to make sure is that everyone is fully trained in the protocols and is using the right words and the right language in the time of crisis and not making things up as we go along. I would like to first make one quick technical change that I believe is necessary after consulting with the Department of Public Safety. On line 1.8, I'd like to change the word develop to maintain. The full 256-hour curriculum that's required to achieve certification in emergency management is already being fully implemented, and I believe that we have more than 4 dozen state employees, I think we're actually maybe even over 5 dozen now, state employees who are fully certified and trained in emergency management and have finished this course. So we just wanted to clarify we're not expecting a whole new curriculum to be developed, but merely to recognize that there is a curriculum in place and it is not yet recognized in statute, and this does so. We asked for a fiscal note. It came back as zero with no cost because these programs are already being paid for by a federal Homeland Security and Emergency Management grant. And all that this would do is just make sure that every agency is moving up the ladder and getting people certified and fully trained to do their jobs in that time of crisis should a disaster hit. So With that, members, I think I'll hand it over to Rocco Forte. With me also today is Doug Freed, from the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers. I think I have that, the acronym correct. And I did not get a chance to see if someone from the Department of Public Safety is here today. Oh, Chris Idy is here. Sorry, I didn't see you when I came in, who I believe will also testify very briefly to the bill.
Representative Kalin, I think your witness grew up in God's country, North Minneapolis, in my district, I believe, and I think went to Patrick Henry, didn't you, where my dad taught for 39 years, so you have a great witness this morning. Mr. Forte.
For reasons other than his birthplace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. On August 7th at 6 o'clock at night, there was a 35W bridge did collapse. At that point in time, we had a federal bridge maintained by the state fell into a county river within the city of Minneapolis on both sides. That is complicated in itself. Along with that, we had multiple incidents within that disaster. We had vehicle fires. We had had to extricate, treat and transfer 121 of the 190 people that were on the bridge at that time. We had vehicle fires. We had a hazmat incident. We had to access county and state divers for the problems that we had in the river. As you can see, that was very, very complicated. What we need is an emergency manager that understands all that dynamic and can work with the 10 responding disciplines. Both disciplines are law enforcement, fire service, hazard materials, emergency medical services, emergency management, health care, public health, governmental administration, public works, and public health public safety communications. So quite frankly, you need a manager that has the skills, knowledge, and ability that can work with all those different disciplines and can get the resources needed to respond, as well as put a plan together and implement that plan and work with the county, work with the city, county, state, and federal government to get resources. There's very few curriculums that teach that. We're very fortunate in the state of Minnesota that we do have, as you said, a 256-hour course that gives emergency managers the basic skills, knowledge, and ability to be able to manage in an incident like this. I totally 100% support this program. I've been through it myself. And quite frankly, I would not have been able to manage the resources without the skills and relationships that were built through those classes. As we take those classes through the state, one process I personally like a lot is the classes are given in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, Marshall, Minnesota, Grand Rapids. So it gives us an opportunity to go through the state, build relationships, understand the resources that are in our state, and build those relationships so we can move those resources back and forth. I would be glad to answer any questions, but the bottom line is I'm very supportive. And from my perspective, 256 hours for somebody to run your largest emergencies is a very small commitment.
Mr. Chair, I am wondering from the witness, how far does this go down, this mandatory training now? Does this go to every police agency? Would every police agency or law enforcement agency, I should say, in the state of Minnesota have to have at least one person that's trained in this plan?
Mr. Forte, through the chair,
my perspective of that is you have to have all your police and fire trained to a certain level. But your emergency manager, the one who's going to coordinate the resources, and from my perspective, three deep in a city like Minneapolis, have to be trained. Every first responder does not need a full certificate. The individual that is going to be in charge of the resources, if you will, the emergency management piece, I always say that these various disciplines like police, fire, medical emergencies are like silos. And the emergency manager builds the skyways between the silos and basically orchestrates the resources during that emergency. So as we're specifically talking about the emergency managers and not the police and fire responders themselves.
Just one second, Representative Kalin. I forgot you didn't formally move your motion to get it in the order that you wanted. So
was that the only amendment to replace develop in line 1.8 with maintain?
Thank you. Is there any discussion? Oh, this is just to get it in the order you want. All in favor, say aye. All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish. One of the things that I learned after being told that there was a little bit of trouble in learning more about the requirements for emergency managers is that there's more required already before House File 3099 becomes law of our local first responders than there is of state of local emergency managers, excuse me, than there is of state emergency managers. And ironically, I passed around the checklist for the curriculum, and ironically, a lot of the volunteer firefighters, not even the chief and assistant chiefs in my community and probably in yours, are more fully trained than was the lead and unfortunately absent individual who was the director of emergency management for MnDOT. The requirement today for locals is if you're a city of less than 10,000, I'm going to look at this ID just to make sure that that I have this right, that if you're a city of less than 10,000, you have to have 110 hours of training, which is a sort of prioritized part of the curriculum. And if you're a city or county larger than 10,000, if you're a city larger than 10,000 or the county, you are required to have a full certification, 256 hours. Right now, the lead directors of emergency response and emergency management in those state agencies do not have that same requirement, and this just requires that they move very quickly to the same expectation that we have of our local.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Thielen, well, bottom line is, as Chief of Police, I just want to make sure that this is, bill isn't encumbering us in any financial way with mandatory training, and that, so whether your answer is no, then we're just not going to make any additional cost to train any of my employees.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, no, it's no cost to the state and no cost to any local. And in fact, I actually have as part of the legislative auditor's investigation of the Sonia Pitt situation, 125 pages I'm happy to share with you. You can read carefully about the National Incident Management System, the NIMS training certification that's required to receive Homeland Security grants now. That's sort of a sub-level. It's the introductory portion of the professional certification course that locals are already required to do. And in fact, I think a lot of the police chiefs that are here are all should be all NIMS certified and NIMS compliant.
Representative Cornish.
Good.
I think, Mr. Chair, briefly, address Representative Cornish's question as well, just if Judge Freed might be able to testify really briefly, and then also if we could get Freed to testify really as well.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. My name is Judson Freed, and I'm the legislative chair and past president of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers. I'm also the director of emergency management homeland security for Ramsey County. So I'm watching out for you as I sit here today. Mr. Chair, Representative, if you put this into more human terms, if your son, unfortunately, were to have some kind of surgery, the team would gather and everybody there would be doing their particular job. The surgeon would be in overall control, but everybody would do their job. The problem would come if the nurse anesthetist there did not speak any medical terminology. She may be an expert, he may be an expert in how to work the equipment, but without being able to speak the language, the outcome for the patient would be grim indeed. The result of that is what we can transfer to any emergency that happens. If everybody on that team doesn't speak the same language, doesn't understand what their role in the big picture is, you end up with catastrophe instead of emergency. The first response people for the state of Minnesota, and in fact nationally, are required to take an extensive amount, and Representative Cornish, I understand your fear there. They're already required to take an extensive amount of federal training in incident management and where they fit as a cog in the wheel. But the people who are coordinating the response of state agencies need to speak the language and need to understand fully not just their part, but everyone else's part. So this bill's intent is to make sure that the people making decisions for the state of Minnesota are at the same level of training that any other emergency manager would be, so that when I show up to a scene, or when Rocco Forte shows up to a scene, or Jim Halstrom from Chisago County shows up to a scene, we don't have to try and figure out whether this state person who's trying to help us is really going to be a hindrance instead. The 400-plus members of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, representing all 87 counties, the cities of the first class, and some 200 other jurisdictions within the state of Minnesota, very strongly support this resolution and hope that the bill will vote.
Thank you. Is there any other discussion on this bill? Okay, represent.
I think we'd just like to hear, just to confirm what I've said about the agreement from the department, from Chris Idy really briefly, and then I know time is short here.
Yes, Ms. Idy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Idy. I am the director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for the Department of Public Safety. As Representative Kalin said, he did discuss this bill with us prior to pulling it together, and we did explain the different types of training that we have in emergency management and the extensive training courses that an emergency management director must go through. For your information, we do have over 600 state employees who have taken at least one course through us. A state agency can track their own training. Otherwise, we do have a training system where we can track towards the certification of emergency management. And a lot of the state agencies are on track for getting at least a minimum of one state employee with full emergency management certification.
And lastly, in the future, I just want to point out that had this bill been law, in 2005, most likely we would have, the excellent folks in Homeland Security would have determined that Sonia Pitt was not advancing towards the certification and would have been that extra little bit of oversight and the reform needed to make sure that we never find ourselves in that situation again.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. Unless there's no further discussion, then Representative Kalin renews his motion to pass as amended and go to the floor and be
registered
to the floor to general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. We're now going to take a recess for 15 minutes. So the committee is recessed for 15 minutes.
Don't worry, I'll be there, Johnny. That's $1 billion.
I'm going to go for a little walk myself here, head back to my office quick. I'll be back. But yeah, I'm going to go to the third floor first.
Look at how they do it in right here.
Yeah, but this is this okay. Their authority is always in my passport. I can hear me not, but what the
I don't know if
you can see that is in law enforcement. And it just basically said they had that, you know, it was just like.
putting that on the internet.
Here.
It's your own desperate attempt to see it.
Well, I called him to stay early in the recess, but he hung around for an hour, and then he hung out with my video, and then I heard someone else bring him in. Took that call.
Was Emmer here? Did you see Emmer? Tom Emmer, did he come here?
Emmer, yeah. He came down and said he'd be in room 200. Can we go up and get him one day?
Yeah.
Who did the meeting?
I'll get him in time for the bullet. Is the chairman against it? You got Paymore? If we lose, we can send it to Paymore.
No, it's going to Paymar anyway, so they won't have another chance. But he doesn't want the pressure because he feels pressure.
He just
going to
kill it right here. He wants to kill it right here.
I'm sure it's
Yeah.
I wouldn't doubt if they don't bring this up today.
What?
They might not bring it up today. They might not see it.
Yeah. Jeremy, where were you? Where did you guys go?
I don't know.
We're in a 15-minute break, so you're maybe there.
Like 10 minutes ago. I'm just got off.
So do you like the hospital?
I have one little concern this morning. I want to...
Yeah, well, go back to Dubba. Jeremy, are you built?
Yes.
When you have it, warm.
I forgot to get my phone.
It's you'd be surprised how many times members talk himself out of a bill.
I'm missing if I know the bill was so tight.
Do you know that a bunch of men that she put her
You're gonna wish you hadn't written it at some point.
That's my real
Right in that Lake Crystal area. When did you end up with that job?
I started July 29th. And then
My dad My dad was an over-the-road truck driver. He was connected with not Price Steel, but the other fabricator. He got hooked in with them guys. Just loved him. He loved the shop floor for him. And, you know, just hang around. And they gave him all the place codes. Wonderful guy. I can't remember his name. Just a group came and they got together. He formed a business. My dad didn't drive trucks. He used to haul a lot of time. He had a weird shape, low, oversized. And but he used to get, they really, really took care of him. In return, he took care of them. It was a really, really neat relationship. Great set of guys that owned the company. I think there's three of them.
It's kind of cute.
They all got their own specialties. One's kind of running the shop.
Why would you ever write that? Did you do a fire
really drill? Just built the things that flourish. You know, it's rolling. I know it's not that. It must be the other one.
Maybe the lady was doing it. Aren't you in charge?
I never was.
I'm a whole over there.
How long do we have this Roman though?
I think we have a shoulder down.
It sounds good in concept. That was the way they did it. But I went on. There were a lot of problems. People would hold on to the day and to get back to their phones. They could use their once it's awarded, I have the much authority you said you do for our kids.
I'm not saying that I'm for or against it.
My wife and I worked it out. Apparently, after the because it was trying.
I'm very
The committee will come back to order after the recess. Representative Posh, your bill 847 is up. Would somebody like to move it? Nobody will move the bill. You might have a problem. That sounds like your. I think your first bill in the committee was like that. Representative Johnson moves House File 847. Representative Posh, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
We're going to limit this to about 8 minutes each way or something like that.
What I would like to do, Mr. Chair, since I am down here at all times and can answer questions from the members, I would rather hand this over to the testifiers who have made their second trip down to testify for this bill because we had to cancel it last Thursday. With me, I have Chief of Police of the City of St. Joseph, Pete Chansky. I have Chief Frank Pomeroy from Winona, and also Mayor Steve Larson from New Brighton. And I would just like to give them the opportunity to address the committee.
Representative Posh, could you have one of them kind of do the whole thing and then the others just kind of say, yes, that's right, or something? So that
would be fun.
We don't hear the same thing over three times. Representative Hover?
Mr. Chair, just when you're allotting time, I did, Representative Westrom asked that I offer his A5 amendment, and I said I would. So I'm hoping in your time allotment, you're going to allow for that to happen as well.
Representative Hosh, you had some amendments you want to take it to get the bill in the order you wanted?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A1, A2, and A3 amendments are small amendments to try to address some of the concerns of the parties involved with this. The A1 amendment would not allow for administrative fines to be given to a CDL license holder. And a little change on that I'd like to see is that on line 1.2 that may be changed to a shall. On Amendment A2, it says that the fine of an administrative fine cannot has to be equal to what the state line is, because we want to have some consistency within the process. And the A3 amendment would not allow for administrative hearings, so we don't have, you know, kind of a city council being the court, judge, and jury when it comes to administrative hearings.
Also, Representative Hosh, Representative Johnson moved the A1 with amendment with line 1.2 may change to shall, the A2 amendment and the A3 amendment to get it in the order that the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just had a question on the A2 amendment.
Oh, can we get it first into the... Normally we just adopt what the author wants and then you ask the questions on it.
Mr. Chair, whatever your pleasure.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No.
No.
Carries. Okay, it's in the shape the author wants. Representative Holbrook has a question on the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is your limitation on the A2 amendment to just the fine, or the fine plus all the surcharges?
Representative Posh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Holbrook. It is just to the fine, and I think that gets to the point of why we're here.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Representative Cornish, is it to one of these? Okay, Representative Cornish.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, the A1 amendment concerns masking the driving record for the CDL, so would it be correct to say that the drivers now of some of the most heavy and possibly, potentially dangerous vehicles driven at high speeds would have a free ride under this amendment? In other words, it says a law enforcement officer may not impose an admin penalty authorized under this section against a person who possesses a license to operate a commercial vehicle. In other words, an 18-wheeler now will know that when he's in one of these cities that's affected by this administrative penalty, that he or she driving it won't be ticketed.
Under the Representative Hosh, wasn't it your intention that it, the regular laws would apply to those?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cornish. In no way would this prevent a law enforcement agency, whether they be city, township, or even state, to administer a regular state-issue ticket. This is just on the administrative issue that we're discussing today.
Representative Cornish.
I understand that, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hosh. It's just the problem is now that the cities, most of them say they're going to use this for 10 and under, so the administrative penalties, but if they get a ticket 10 and under, I guess it's just a moot point.
Okay. Representative Hosh, go ahead with your...
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to hand this over to Chief Pomeroy of...
Chief Pomeroy.
Good morning, Chair and Representative. Thank you for allowing me to be here this morning. I'll be here testifying and representing the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association and the Minnesota Sheriff's Association in support of the Hosh Bill. This is my third year here, and I've testified previously, and I will go through some of the points that I think are critical. The first is, you know, I've heard testimony for the past 3 years about revenue and loss of revenue to the state of Minnesota, and I can talk specifically about the Winona Plan as we administer administrative fines, and as we have done so for the past 5 years. Not one penny of revenue collected by the state, by the city of Winona, would have gone to the state of Minnesota. Traditionally in the city of Winona, and really because the district really didn't want us bringing violations that were trivial in the area of 0 to 10 miles an hour into their courts, basically put a mandate out to our officers that we should not write tickets for 0 to 10 miles an hour. So officers in the city of Winona, really for the past 10 years, I've been the chief there for 21 years, have really written either, I've either given written warnings or verbal warnings for people who violated in the area of 0 to 10 miles an hour, which generated absolutely no revenue, which did not show up on driver's licenses, which did not affect insurance rates. So nothing has changed. What has changed is that when we administer an administrative fine of $45, it seems to have an impact on violators when in fact written and verbal warnings did not. And let me be clear on this. It has been an absolute wonderful program for the city of Winona. I almost got thrown out of town when I suggested this program 5 years ago, to be honest with you. I had people who lived just outside of the jurisdiction come in and say, we're not going to come into Winona because it's going to turn into a speed trap. Now it is widely accepted. It is one of the best programs that I, the chief, have instituted in my tenure. And it has, for the most part, taken a traditional level of accidents, the range between 1,250 and 1,400, and moved that down to a range of 830 to 900 accidents a year, a drop of more than 25 to 30%. Now, if you take a look at the insurance industry in particular, you would think that they would be in favor of that, because a 25 to 30% drop in accidents in our city cost them a lot less dollars than what they're paying now for the number of accidents that we had in the past. We have a very diverse population in Winona, with a population of 25,000 citizens and an additional 13,000 college students that come into our community every year, and with a lot of different driving habits, I must say. And that's why this program, the Administrative Fines, has been so valuable to us, because we have, through these fines, been able to change behavior, and it has worked well for us. There was a press release last week from the Third Judicial District in the city of in the state of Minnesota. I have about 10 copies of this that I would like to share with you, and I will do that. But if you read the top, it says budget shortfall, force of layoffs, position consolidations, operational changes in Third Judicial District courts, reduced services, and delays imminent. They're facing a $300,000 shortfall and a $1.1 million shortfall by the end of the biennium on June 30th of 2009. Those shortfalls are for a couple of reasons. One, the number of interpreters that they have to now supply to the court, and secondarily, the number of psychological evaluations that are really being utilized to keep sexual predators committed and behind bars or in treatment centers. If you look at the first line here, it says, scheduling a court appearance and judicial decisions may be delayed as a result of a reduction in legal research positions. It goes on and on and on. And we have just recently started a criminal justice coordinating committee in our county, and I serve on that with other distinguished members of who work in criminal justice within our area. And they really are at the point with these shortfalls, layoffs, and other things going on, asking me if there's not a possibility that I can't make more inclusive some of the things that we may now bring into the administrative fine area. I have been reluctant to do that. And one of the reasons why is because of a large college population, alcohol is prominent within our community. And there's a tiered system within the court system to deal with that. I don't want to take those into administrative fines because I don't think that the penalty is going to be severe enough. But I may have to do that with what the court is facing. We lost revenue last year in the city of Winona. And one of the reasons we lost revenue is because in tough economic times, what happens is that people can't afford surcharges, library fees, and fines. So much of the judiciary in Winona County have been taking the surcharges and the library fees and eliminating fines completely. We lost almost $30,000 in revenue last year because of that. We brought in $25,000 in administrative fines, which comes fairly close to offsetting that loss. But we have a budget of $31 million in our city, and we bring in $25,000 in revenue from administrative fines that we use to promote and further promote traffic safety within our community.
Representative Hosh, we've already gone quite a bit over the time, so I think we have to allow the other side to... And who, is there any opposition to this? Mr. Gillespie, you're getting to be a regular. Is there anybody else from the opposition? Cornish, I don't think you're going to testify. Mr. Gillespie, state your name and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Gillespie, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Chief Officers Association. We're the organization that represents line police officers, about 8,000 of them across the state of Minnesota. Let me clarify one thing. Representative Cornish is certainly qualified to testify on this issue as both a chief and as a law enforcement officer, and as the author of a bill that opposed this point of view. The Board of Directors of the MPPOA opposes
the use of administrative fines and in lieu of tags written under the appropriate state statute. I want to clarify that. The primary purpose of the local jurisdiction's use of administrative punishment is revenue enhancement. The money raised, I'm going to skip a portion, the money raised by the surcharges on traffic tags is used to support the police officer standards and training board reimbursement fund, which is used to reimburse local units of government for the cost of the training of police officers. No money from an administrative fine goes anywhere but into the public purse of a local unit of government. When police officers issue an administrative citation for traffic, the surcharge is not collected. Local units of government and their representatives want two bites of the apple. They want the money from the reimbursement fund and all the money from the administrative fine. One feeds the other. The argument that police officers do not write tags because they don't like the cost of the fine and the attendant surcharge is specious, but it might be true. But it's not important. What police officers feel about a fine schedule is not relevant. When I was a tin can in St. Paul and Ramsey County, I had no clue what the Ramsey County fine schedule was for traffic offenses. It's not relevant, frankly. It's either an offense, or it's either a violation of the law or it's not, and you have certain preconditions that you have that you might look at as to whether you're going to write a tag or not. It has nothing at all to do with what the cost of the penalty might be. The National Transportation Board lists right-angle motor vehicle accidents as the leading contributor to death and injuries sustained in motor vehicle accidents. And I don't know of any officer who simply refuses to issue a tag for a blown stop sign or semaphore. To suggest otherwise is both an insult to the integrity and decision-making of police officers and a threat to the state of Minnesota's authority to issue commercial driver's licenses. Their concern about masking violation on the driver's record remains unresolved. Most importantly, I want to leave you with the fact that a traffic tag is a teaching tool and not a means to generate money for the general fund of the state of Minnesota. It certainly was never intended to fill the purses of local units of government. However, a total of $63 million was transferred to the general fund from 2002 to 2006. The use of administrative citations for traffic offenses threatens both the money for post-reimbursement account and the general fund. I'll skip to the last point I wanted to raise today. An opinion issued December 1st, 2003, the Attorney General of the State of Minnesota issued an opinion that local units of government are not permitted to usurp the powers reserved by the state in control of public behavior, specifically in the sanctions of police officers. I'm not sure you have the authority to transfer to local units of government the ability to regulate traffic. I don't think you want to do that. And I'm suggesting that it's bad public policy. Now, you may choose to disagree with me, but I think that's bad public policy. Most importantly, I wanted to leave you with the fact that the FEPOA has a specific interest in this and that we certainly helped create this fund originally when it was first passed by the legislature. We did it because we wanted a dedicated source of funding for police training. Administrative fines threatens that funding. Jim King from the Department of Revenue has issued a report that shows funding for the post ward has been, the reimbursement fund has been going down steadily through the last 5 or 6 years. You can't argue with those numbers. We want to make sure that you're aware of the fact that if you permit this, those numbers will not increase, okay, and that there would be a hole there in the general fund. And I'll conclude my remarks because I know that we're busy this morning and we're short on time.
Representative Holberg, I believe, is going to move the A5 amendment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question. I don't know if we're allowed to ask questions at this point.
Well, we were going to take the amendment first, but...
All right. This amendment is on behalf of Representative Westrom, and it's pretty self-explanatory, in that you would be able to add petty misdemeanors to this. An individual would reserve the right to be able to go to court, that's the subdivision 2, and plead their case in court. And if they chose not to go to court but to pay the fine, it would be deposited in the general fund or the county or city. that assess the administrative penalty. I do not support the amendment. I don't support the bill. But I did say to my friend, Tori, that I would present the amendment. He had to leave. I think there was a family
okay.
emergency.
There's
a
Representative Hodge, I assume you oppose it also?
Well, Mr. Chair, this is the first that I've heard of this amendment. I haven't been informed that this was going to be offered.
And Mr. Chair, my apologies. I wasn't aware of that. Had I known that, I would have shared it with you earlier. But
Representative Hosh, do you want to state a position on this quickly?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's my intention, from the very beginning of this legislation to have this as an evolving bill to try to improve it or to address any concerns. I'm willing to do that as we continue to move forward in the process, but due to the bill, with me not having the ability to really see how this is going to impact my bill, I would have to oppose it at this point. But also letting the members know that I may be able to support this as I consider it more.
So at this point, it doesn't sound like it'll help your bill.
So at this time,
all in favor of the A5 amendment say aye. All opposed say no. Defeated. Okay, back to the bill. Representative Holberg, you had a question.
Thank you. What is being done to make the cities comply with the Attorney General's ruling?
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg. To my knowledge, not a whole lot. At this point, why I'm here today is because of the recognition that we have dozens, if not over 100 cities doing this already with very inconsistent ways of applying administrative fines, the amount of the fine, and it is my goal to bring some consistency and some parameters to the process. Could I address some of the, Mr. Chair, maybe not at this point of questioning, but at some point I would like to address some of the comments that were made.
And Mr. Chair, I guess I didn't get my question answered. Does anybody in the room know of any efforts being made to stop this process in the cities across the state as a result of the AG's ruling?
Doesn't look like there's anybody responding, Representative Holberg.
So I guess we have to wait.
Nobody.
For Representative Cornish's bill, I guess.
Representative Cornish's bill, I think, is mired in some committee. I believe his companion bill in the Senate has been replaced by this bill, so he's not going well on his bill. Representative Cornish, you had a quick question, I think, or a comment?
A comment. And members, I've distributed all my talking points to you, and rather than go on for hours, I want to just make a couple of quick comments for brevity's sake here. But usually, to the chief here, I come over and tell war stories about wrestling matches and this and that during the break. The reason I didn't today is because I'm embarrassed for your organization. And it sounds like a rude comment, but you're changing the whole spectrum of law enforcement here today. And my question is, I don't want to say hell in committee, maybe it's a bad word, but what in the hell are we doing writing tickets for under 10 miles an hour? I've written tickets since I was 20 years old, thousands of tickets. Never have I written a ticket for under 10 miles an hour. I don't care if it's an administrative penalty and rolling through stop signs. Why are we writing tickets now in the talking point for rolling through stop signs? What this is a money grab. You shouldn't be writing tickets for under 10 miles an hour. You shouldn't be writing tickets for... What happened to the warning ticket? And I want to caution the GFL members here, before you vote for this today, think about that. You're increasing the chance of your constituents 50% getting a ticket under this thing. What we used to get tickets for, it has nothing to do with price. When I first started writing tickets, they were $25 a ticket. I still gave warning for under 10 miles an hour, and I still gave warning for rolling through stop signs. All of a sudden now, when it's a money grab... And every chief that I've talked to has said revenue or budgetary operations is why they need it in loss of LGA. This is a political bill for loss of LGA, and I'd love to work with them to get a more LGA. But that's what this bill is. And it's a burden on our citizens to make up for city shortfalls.
Okay. Is there, Representative Kosh, can you limit your comments because we want to get this vote on?
Sure. Thank
one
you,
way
sir.
Or the other.
I want to address the issue of revenue enhancement. If I may, for a second. I don't know if any of the members have read the report by the state auditor in which we interviewed the cities doing this bill. But I don't think the facts are showing that this is a revenue enhancement mechanism. With this report, the cities that had this over 3 years, they've raised only 1% of the general fund through administrative tickets, and that has not gone up. Counties that do administrative tickets, in 04 had 0.4% of their general fund raised by administrative tickets, and now it's down to 0.2%. If there's an argument that state tickets may go down, that hasn't come to fruition. State tickets from 04 to 05 among the participants in the study increased by 25.6%, and from 05 to 06 went up by 17.8%. When we're talking about tickets under 10 miles an hour, I live in a residential neighborhood with a 30 mile an hour speed limit. If somebody's going 9 miles an hour over, and my son is playing in the front yard, they're exceeding the speed limit by over 30%. And I think that our police officers should have the tools in their toolbox to be able to make a determination to use the discretion that they think is appropriate. This is not a money grab, and I'm more than willing to address any of the concerns of the members on this committee, but I do want to make sure to clarify some of the claims made.
If it passes, it has another stop. So Representative Johnson renews his motion to pass without recommendation to Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
I believe it carried, but there's been a division. Yeah. For all in favor, raise your hand. Okay. All opposed. Okay. It fails 6-8. Okay. Then I believe the committee is adjourned.